Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The banking industry in this country is changing. It's not only because of online banking or ATMs. It's also because banks are not meeting the financial needs of a huge segment of the population. Millions are turning to alternative banking sources, including payday lenders and check cashing centers. Put it all together, and it's called unbanking. What's happening and why? We'll find out in our discussion with Lisa Servon, who teaches city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania. And she is the author of the new book, The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. Vita Jeffrey is co-chair of the St. Louis Regional Unbanked Task Force, Bank on Save Up St. Louis. And Ray Bouchara is the director of the Center for Household Financial Stability at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. They're participating in a discussion on unbanking tomorrow. I'll have more on that a little bit later, and I welcome you all. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Great to be
Thank
here.
You. Thank
Lisa,
you.
Lisa, let me start with you. I read from some of your writing that the vast majority, maybe 99% of the population, is not being served well by banking.
Well, that's a big statement. It depends on how you define it. But we do know that 20% of Americans are what's called underbanked, meaning they have a bank, but they also use alternative financial services like check cashers and payday lenders. And another 8% are unbanked totally, meaning they have no bank account at all. And rely on other kinds of informal and alternative financial services. We also know that 138 million Americans are financially unhealthy, meaning that they're really struggling with financial services and getting making ends meet and meeting their financial obligations. So it's a big issue.
You write about the middle class and the changing middle class, but it seems to me, given the numbers you've just given, that we're talking about poor people primarily.
It's both, really, and that's one of the big points. I did this research for the book. I worked as a teller at a check cashier and a payday lender, and one of the things that I found was that it wasn't just low-income people who were using these services. More and more, we're finding that it's people who have a decent job, making $50,000 or $75,000 a year, or people who've gone to college, people who own their homes, are still struggling financially, can't come up with $500 in the case of an emergency. 75% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So it's a big and growing problem.
Obviously it is. Vita, let me turn to you. From your perspective, what does this all mean to you?
You know, first of all, I enjoyed reading the book and just seeing it put into simple terms. But the interesting thing to me is seeing how we have the opportunity to pull the banks together to be an answer to what was discovered in all of the studies there. We see here locally through our organization, the St. Louis Regional Unbanked Task Force, banks coming together to start trying to figure out the answer. How can we get on board? We see the problem. Now, how can we be part of the solution as to what's going on?
Well, there must be a slight element of panic here if So many people are no longer customers or never have been customers.
Absolutely. If the bottom line is to be able to turn a profit and you're everywhere you turn, you're seeing that there's an issue saying that, one, you're not communicating well, two, you don't have the right products, and three, people are running to their detriment away from you. There has to be a panic to figure out how do we get this thing right.
Ray Bouchara, from the Fed's standpoint, how are you guys looking at this?
Well, at my center at the Fed, we're looking at family wealth, balance sheet, savings, assets, and debts. That matters in ways that your income and your job don't matter. When you have wealth, it's harder to fall back, but it's a lot better to move forward if you have some wealth for you and your kids. This issue matters because without a healthy banking relationship, it's going to be really hard to build wealth, hard to move forward. And like Lisa mentioned, we're finding in our own research that up to 2/3 of Americans are financially struggling. So when you don't have the right access point to the financial system, it's really hard to build wealth and have security for you and your family.
You know, I was thinking before doing this program, I can't remember the last time I was actually in a bank. You know, I do online banking and use the ATMs and all the rest of it. Is that a bad thing, Lisa? I mean, a lot of people are doing that, I suppose.
I think it depends on who you ask, right? So for me, and probably all of us at this table, I like being able to pay my bills online in my pajamas late at night or on Sunday. Even though I went to the bank every week with my dad when I was growing up, it was part of my acculturation as a financial consumer. But many of the people who came to the check casher and the payday lender where I worked felt that that relationship was important. They felt that they weren't being served very well. They perhaps weren't sophisticated enough to use online banking or didn't feel safe enough or sometimes couldn't even get a bank account. And so the service that they got coming in week after week at the check casher mattered to them. And I think that's certainly one of the things that we need to think about if we think about moving people to a better financial institution or structure is how can we provide that level of service? Everyone I know up and down the income scale, most people are not feeling so great about the service they get from their banks.
What does this mean for the future of banks, Ray?
Well, I think that banks are going to have to change. Technology's already changing and, you know, creating opportunities. I think nonprofits have to think differently, credit unions. I mean, the world has changed enough that I think the banking industry and those connected to it have to change as well. So I think the future is actually bright because we're in the midst of a lot of really promising innovation. We haven't got all the answers yet, but the right questions are being pursued.
Vita, you're nodding, and you mentioned earlier that you're doing a lot of thinking about this sort of thing. What are you thinking?
Well, absolutely. You know, my mom will be, in a month's time, she'll turn 80 years old, and she takes advantage of the opportunity to take pictures of her checks and have them automatically deposit. However, if she doesn't go into, when she makes her trips to the bank, if they don't know her, it does leave her feeling disconnected. And so while I celebrate all of the technological advances, I do think that there is still time for banks to understand how do we still continue to stay engaged? Because as the book shows, as you show so clearly in the book, people need that engagement. And so the banks really have to walk and chew gum.
You know, they need the engagement. The customers, the clients need the engagement too if they need a loan. I mean, you have to have some sort of a personal relationship with a banker, don't you, to take out a mortgage loan or whatever it might be.
Absolutely, because a loan deals with more than just what's on my paperwork. A loan has to deal with what I'm finding from this person. You know, what's their situation? What's their intent? How do I know them? And the only way that they're going to be able to stay on top of that is through those relations.
I'm more cynical, I'd say, about banks, you know, about them actually changing at this moment. We've seen a real pullback on those kinds of personal loans. I talked to so many people who were taking payday loans, and they said, look, it used to be that I could go in and I could ask for a $500 loan, especially, let's just say, for white people, right? It's almost never been like that in neighborhoods of color unless you were at a black-owned bank. But now, you know, I had people saying, look, I've been coming to this bank for 20 years. I get my paycheck deposited every 2 weeks, and now I can't get that loan. They should know me. They should respect me. And so, you know, first of all, that spectrum of banks is pretty broad. We now have a situation where the four biggest banks hold more than half of all consumer deposits, and they are some of the ones who are not doing as well by people. We've just seen the Wells Fargo scam. Mm-hmm. I live in New York City, where the city created an ID card so that people who didn't have a driver's license or a passport could use that as an official form of ID, and the biggest banks aren't taking it. It's the smaller banks that have really dwindled in number who are more likely to serve people, but they're really struggling.
One of the things you write that I found especially interesting is that a lot of the people who are served by payday lenders find them to be, and check cashing services, find them to be more transparent than the local bank.
Absolutely. And that, you know, part of this is regulation, right? So payday lenders and check cashers are required to put the information about their products and the fees in very big font on the walls. So if you walk into a check casher, which I would encourage everybody to do, the signs above the window look like a fast food restaurant. Where I worked in the South Bronx, it would tell you it's $1.50 to cash a check, 89 cents for a money order, 2% of your face value of your check to cash it. And if you imagine someone who's never had a bank account walking into a bank, and the fact that there's almost no signage there, it can be pretty overwhelming and daunting. And, you know, checking disclosure agreements, which we all get when we open a checking account, are 44 pages long of fine print. So people then feel like they don't know when that monthly minimum monthly charge is coming out. They didn't realize that if they charged a $5 cup of coffee, they could be hit with a $35 overdraft fee. So they end up feeling like they've been tricked, which is not exactly the feeling you want from customers that you hope will be loyal to you.
Right. Fees are what we hear complained about
all the time.
The most. Yeah. So the banks have got to change that. Of course, they're looking for ways to make money. We understand the capitalist system. But nonetheless, the fees are mm-hmm. killing people. So what do we do about that? We just drop the fees, change the fees?
Well, look, I should first say I work on the research side of the bank, not the banking side of the bank. Uh-huh. But yes, transparency is always good. More information. We're huge on financial education. But I also think the institutions have to change, and they have to disclose things better. They have to better engage their customers. They need to be clear about what they're getting and what they're not getting and why they add value. You know, what's the value proposition here? Am I worth the money I'm going to pay to a bank to do my banking? And I don't think the value proposition is clear.
Vita, who is more predatory, the payday lender or the bank?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Sorry, I didn't get that one.
Are you happy that I asked you that question?
Right, I get that. Well,
I think the other two are very happy I asked you and not them.
Here's what I will say. I want to go back to what Lisa said, because Lisa's coming from a global perspective, and my role is more local in terms of understanding how our banks are answering the call. And in that, I'm going to answer that question by saying locally, the predatory side is going more towards the check cashing and payday loan side because we have some local bankers that are absolutely trying to get it right. They're looking at opening more locations in the community. They're looking at doing the training from the top down. If we don't have the buy-in from the bank owners and the presidents, then we won't get what you're speaking to. And we have some banks here that are showing we have buy-in. We're really trying to make sure we have the products, the services, and the community relationships that we need to be able to kind of move that needle. And so as long as we have that, I won't answer that our banks are more so in that role.
Are those banks that are coming around, are they dropping fees? Are they doing the kinds of obvious things?
They absolutely are. They're having products. They're meeting the we have Bank On 2.0, which is asking some real stringent changes in the products and services that they add. And we have some banks that are moving to meet that.
Yeah. I have to take a break. Lisa, hang on for just a second, if you would. I'll come back and ask that same question.
Okay.
You guys aren't off the hook yet. We'll come back in just a moment. And I'll also invite listeners to come into the conversation. If you have experiences with your bank that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you would prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. Banking, modern banking, and unbanking. That's our subject today. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Lisa Servan, professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about a book that she has written called Unbanking, What's Happening. Well, it's not the title of it. I'm looking at something else here. I can't find the exact title because it's a long one. Author of The Unbanking of America, How the Middle Class Survives. Also with us is Vita Jeffrey, co-chair of the St. Louis Regional Unbanked Task Force. And Ray Bashar is director of the Center for Household Financial Stability with the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis. We're getting some calls, and I want to get to them. But, Lisa, let me come back to you just to be fair about this with regard to the, you know, who's more predatory, banking or the payday lenders?
So why not take a stab at the hard question? I think what Vita and I were both doing was kind of drawing a distinction between some of the very large banks and the smaller, more community-oriented one. And what we've seen is that with the large ones that do hold most Americans' deposits, their business models have changed. And Ray was talking about the value proposition. So, you know, as we changed legislation, deregulated, they got to be bigger. They got to branch, buy insurance companies, do a lot of business overseas, and they became less reliant on the average everyday consumer who put, you know, a little bit of money by to buy a house or save for retirement. And so they're less dependent on the little guy for their business, which I think translates into distancing themselves more from communities. Mm-hmm. The way that they make money off of lower income people is through these fees, mm-hmm. right? And that's not good for the consumer. So for smaller banks, which are increasingly getting gobbled up by the bigger ones, they're the ones that are making loans to local businesses that will sit down with you and have a conversation about maybe getting a personal loan or look beyond your credit score in order to make a decision about you. So unfortunately, the information for consumers about where to bank is not that clear. You know, credit unions generally charge less. People overall pay fewer fees per year at a credit union than at a bank. Smaller banks are generally better, but consumers really need the information in order to ask several questions about practices and figure out where to bank best. And that's not so – that's incumbent on us and people in the public sector to make that information easy to get a hold of.
Ray, do you want to take a crack at that question that I've asked the others? Or
not really. I mean, I don't think you can – it's not so neat, you know, that one is more predatory than the other. I think there are predatory practices among mainstream bankers and among alternative financial mm-hmm. providers, as well as in the informal sector. So that's the bigger issue. It's not one or the other.
What about the issue of trust? It's been alluded to. I mean, the big banks we've all been reading about in the last 8 years or 9 years or so about the big banks and – some of the stunts that have been pulled to make money. Does trust work into this whole issue of everybody's nodding their head? Let me start with you, Ray, on that, and then I'll go to Vidi.
Well, I think trust does matter a lot when you're talking about your money, your mm-hmm. assets, your future, your dreams, your security. So trust is naturally a part of the equation. But I'd like to turn to Lisa. She has some research in her book about the level of trust among consumers, especially millennials, around financial institutions that I think would be interesting to share.
Yeah, I think, well, if you look at the data, trust is at an all-time low in banks right now, really since the financial crisis. And I think you say that play out in differently in different communities. So for millennials, you know, unlike probably all of us at this table, no one can see us, but we are a little older than the millennial age, I think. We didn't grow up going to banks. Millennials didn't grow up going to banks with their parents. It wasn't part of their practice. They see their parents doing online banking. They're really comfortable putting their information into their phones and using devices to manage their money. So there isn't that kind of a connection, and they really mistrust banks. There's a piece of data that was done that showed that most millennials would rather talk to a dentist than a banker, and all four big banks are on their list of most hated brands. Now, then you get the people who are living in lower income communities, and they really see oftentimes the check casher as a local community business that will help them out. So I worked for 4 months in the South Bronx. People tipped me for good service. Hmm. Sometimes people brought the tellers coffee in the morning. They knew how we took our coffee because they saw us all the time. They would bring in, let's say this was a mostly Spanish-speaking community, and people would bring in a document from the IRS or from their electric bill that was in English and ask us to help them translate it. So there was this sense of it being a place where you could get a lot of things done and where people would be helpful. And the two tellers I worked with day in and day out had both been there for 10 years. So they were institutions in that community.
And millennials especially trust technology. They trust Google. They trust mm-hmm. Apple, right? Mm-hmm. They trust Amazon. And so, you know, thankfully, technology firms are getting into this space and, you know, I think constructively overall.
But before the program, I was talking to someone who qualifies as a millennial, and he was saying that he's concerned, you know, with the whole hacking situation. He doesn't like to take a picture, a photo of his check and send it. And, you know, we're all aware of what's going on out there, that so many people are having access to our private information. Mm-hmm. So that's just one story. How about you, Vidi, with the issue of trust?
You know, I think that's really key. I wanted to find some data, but we have a local bank where a woman has been there like 30-some-odd years at this point, and she knows every individual that walks into her bank. Mm-hmm. And what she's formed is those trust relationships where they come to her for any and everything beyond banking. And you see that if we take those roles to get to know, you really do control the reputation of the bank itself. And sure. So our banks would do a better job of recognizing that and maintaining people. What you hit on was understanding there's a big turnover mm-hmm. in those community roles. Mm-hmm. And our big banks are being controlled by the people that are in those seats and the power that they give them to be able to interact with the community. So that makes a difference.
As I said, we have a number of callers, and let's get them into the conversation. We'll start with Alan, who is calling from Eureka. Alan, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Are you there now?
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I was wondering when fees are fair for banks to charge and when they're not. Case in point is I had some bank accounts at a local bank here, and all of a sudden I noticed that they're charging me $20 a month. And I called them on it, and they said, well, that's an inactivity fee. I said, well, an inactivity fee, I got $12,000 in the account. And for years, people would put money in banks for safekeeping, so if you needed it, it would be there. Could you comment on that?
Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, there are banks who will charge you a monthly fee if unless you do one transaction a month at least for inactivity. Now, why they would do that except to make money, I have no idea, because if you're not doing anything, you're obviously not costing them anything, right? You're not calling a teller, you're not standing in line, or you're even using a machine that might break down. So yeah, it's. I mean, we've seen banks since the 1980s, banks used to make most of their money on interest, and now they make much more from fees. And this is just another example of one that's not in the customer's best interest.
And not
go ahead, Dina.
Well, what we're doing is that they're not working with the bank on 2.0 standards, which would alleviate that. And
right.
If we could get them to understand that, it would keep from calls like this coming in.
So how do you get them to do anything that you want? I mean, does it have to be done legislatively, or is it community pressure, or is it what?
Well, just as a general statement, I think we have to strike a balance between consumer protection, and that's whether they're at a bank, a check casher, or a fintech company, a technology company. You need the protections. People need that. They need that for trust. At the same time, if they don't have space to innovate and figure out the business model and figure out the value proposition, we're never really going to get out of this. So there's too many changes going on to not allow and encourage innovation. So there need to be safe spaces for banks and others to innovate while we continue to protect consumers.
Does the current situation in Washington, where there's a talk about dismantling Dodd-Frank and the consumer protection thing is now in some jeopardy, is all of that playing into this right now?
Well, I think it is in part. So when Ray talks about consumer protection, you know, the primary agency that does that in Washington is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It was created as part of Dodd-Frank. For Alan, the caller who just called in, there is a complaint portal on the CFPB's website. And, you know, what we see a lot of times is banks doing things that are legal. That bank is not doing anything illegal by making that charge. But I would argue that it's unethical, right? It's charging people for something that seems meaningless. So he can register a complaint there. The bank may just say it's legal. He can take his money out and put it someplace else, which is what I would do, even though it's a hassle. But yeah, I mean, the CFPB is really under threat right now from the new administration, which has promised to gut it. The CHOICE Act was just passed by the House a couple of weeks ago. This is really a dangerous time. Consumer protection in financial services is really under threat. And when we see all the bad things that have happened, even since Dodd-Frank and even since the CFPB was formed, I think it's proof that we really need that consumer watchdog.
So all of the things we're talking about here and all the need for change is in some jeopardy now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And actually, it's the CFPB that's also trying to help innovators have a way to innovate and experiment a little bit without being overly burdened by regulation.
Let's take another call. We'll bring in Kiri, I believe it is, calling from St. Louis. Kiri, I hope I've pronounced your name correctly.
Yes, I'm calling from St. Louis City, and I also have a concern about overdraft fees. I bank with a major nationwide bank in here, you know, in the U.S., and I had an overdraft. And then a merchant I had to do a return, and a merchant made a mistake in the return, and it resulted in me getting charged $35, and I had to fight tooth and nail to get the bank to credit it. And then my second issue is that I've noticed recently that when I tried to set up overdraft protection on my bank account, I would get charged $35 for using the overdraft protection, or I would get charged $35 for not having overdraft protection if I made a mistake. It seems like a catch-22, and I don't know how that's fair. And then the third question that I have is, how is it that banks are able to pick and choose which transactions to honor so that they can actually cause an overdraft that could have otherwise been avoided by rearranging the order in which
yes.
they process your transactions?
Thank you, Kiri. Go ahead, Vita.
You know, that's been a long-standing concern. As far back as I can remember, that's always been the thought that banks process money going out before money coming in, mm-hmm. or money sitting, and how that affects the community. And I can't even say right now, so not to keep tooting the horn of BankOn 2.0, but there are some specifics in there that would allow banks to be able to address concerns like hers, the overdraft fees and the insufficient funds and how that affects them. We're not saying that banks need to completely walk away from making money, because they do have to turn a profit, but it's the way that they're going about working with those individuals. With the St. Louis Region 9 Bank Task Force, one of the things that we do is try to work with banks and the community so that they can understand each other better. One of the things Lisa said earlier is going into a check cashing place, you see everything on the wall, so you understand all of the particulars that you need to deal with, and going into a bank, you don't. But when you have that actual relationship with your banker, that's where all of that information is made clear. And I think I heard her say the caller say she was dealing with a larger bank, and ours is more of the engagement with our local community bank. So,
Lisa?
Well, just responding to Kira for a second, I mean, two things that she said. One is about this, what's called debit resequencing, which more than 40% of banks engage in, where, you know, if you have $100 in your account and you, on one day, you charge $25 at the grocery store, you buy, you pay your phone bill for $50 and you write your landlord a check for $500. And if all those charges hit your account on the same day, mm-hmm. maybe you deposited a check 2 days ago for $2,000 that you thought would clear, but it didn't, mm-hmm. because the bank held your money. The bank is going to reorder those debits, putting the $500 one first, which would then end up charging you 3 overdraft fees instead of putting 25 and then 50. Now, that is perfectly legal, right, that they're doing that. And yet it makes my blood boil, and obviously Kira's blood too. So, I think this is something that we have to speak out about and fight against. And the second thing was about overdraft protection. Now banks have to ask you to opt in or opt out to it. I think the way to avoid overdraft fees is to opt out, tell them you don't want it. But the way that banks ask you in many times is so opaque that most people don't know whether they've opted in or opted out. And I think, you know, to Vita's point, BankOn 2.0 is doing amazing work, and yet banks don't have any pressure to abide by those regulations. And so we have to figure out how to hold their feet to the fire.
Well, you say it's it's perfectly legal what they're doing. It sounds criminal to me. I mean,
exactly.
what Kiri brought up, $35, and what's worth $35 in that transaction? Take another call here. Dwayne joins us from St. Louis. Make it fast, though, Dwayne, if wood time's running away.
Yes, sir. I remember Boatman's Bank. And as soon as Boatman's, and it was a part of the community, and as soon as it got taken over by Bank of America, they feed and feed and feed, so I left them for Pulaski. You can stand in line at a Boatman's Bank, and the line can be 10 people long. They'll want you to open a loan, but they won't get one more person up there to help you cash your check. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Anybody Rita, you look
no
like
response to that.
Here,
it's
here.
Been gobbled up 3 or 4 times.
I grew up going to a bank called Pulaski, so...
Jersey girl, that's
Jersey
right.
Girl,
it's a big name in Jersey.
It is.
Ray, time is winding down, but how did banks used to make their money before all of this stuff started happening? Was it just through loans and lending?
Well, it was primarily, as Lisa alluded to, through the spread. You know, they could loan out money at a higher rate, than they could pay on interest, and that mm-hmm. was a large part of their bank. It was community driven, relationship driven. So, yeah, that's the old model, and that's clearly the model, as Lisa said, that it's just not really working anymore for them.
Is that what we want to go back to?
I think it would be great in some ways. I would say, yeah, and I think that's what a lot of these smaller banks are trying to do, but it's very hard for them to compete. You know, Paul Krugman, from the New York Times columnist, wrote an article shortly after the crisis called "Let's Make Banking Boring Again," and people used to call that the 363 era of banking, which meant you'd get 3% interest on your savings account, they'd charge you 6% interest on your loans, and the bankers could go to the golf course by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And those days are gone.
Can I just say, I think, look, the solutions go beyond the banking industry, you know, much bigger. Like, you know, this, the issues of lower incomes, higher volatility and unpredictability, lack of savings, high debts. This is a big public policy economic growth problem. We don't get families with more income and more savings and more assets. It's going to be hard to solve this. But also, I think we have to think about bank accounts as a public good. We think about water and utilities as public goods. We need to think about bank accounts as public goods because they're so essential for financial stability.
Did you want to say something, Virginia?
Well, I want to say to that, you're right. And the key to that that we found is our banks working in conjunction with our not-for-profit organizations to kind of bring that partnership for community education, financial education, and those pieces. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have found works well.
We have a number of calls here, not enough time to take them, but Vita, they're all referring to credit unions. We've alluded to credit unions who are saying, this is the way I go and it's working very well for me. Are they really different?
You know, there is a difference, but there has to be room for both credit unions and the way that they function. And I'm a member of several, so I love them, but there still has to be a role for bankers and get and holding them accountable so that they can fill that same need.
Lisa, thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues with credit unions is that not everybody lives or works in a place where they have access to them. Mm-hmm. I think they're often a good solution. They often do provide lower cost loans and lower fees. The difference in the business model is that at a credit union, you're actually a member. It's a cooperative, mm-hmm. whereas banks' incentive is to make as much money as possible for their shareholders. That's different for credit unions. So just looking at those two business models, it becomes pretty clear.
Would, if the credit union is available to a community, would you recommend they go to the credit union rather than a bank?
In general, yes. I would say if I had to decide, I would ask a few questions first because, you know, not every, there's, with every kind of business, there's a range from good to bad. But overall, I would say go for the credit union.
All right. Ray, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I bank at a credit union and an online bank.
So. Well, I think that's the answer to the question then right there. Let me point out, and again, we have a minute left, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis presents The Banking and Unbanking of America, a local conversation with author Lisa Servon tomorrow morning from 9 to 11. That's going to be at the St. Louis Public Library downtown. Lisa's with us in studio, as is Ray Bishara with Federal Reserve Bank here in St. Louis, and Vita Jeffrey, co-chair of the St. Louis Regional Unbanked Task Force. Just a few seconds left. Does anyone want to put a bottom line on this? Lisa, as our guest from out of town, what do you want people to take away from this conversation?
I think that we are in a moment of a lot of innovation and maybe even creative destruction in the financial services industry. As Ray said, there's a huge need out there. The innovation is not necessarily coming from the banks or the check cashers and the payday lenders. I think we'll see a lot of really interesting things coming out using technology, but people really need to learn about their financial options and figure out how to make a choice that fits their needs and their situation.
Thank you so much. You've got to stop it there. Lisa Servon, thank you for being with us. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Vita Jeffrey, thank you for being with us as well. Ray Bishara, thank you too.
You're welcome.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.